New World Witchery is possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors. We'd like to take a moment to recognize our producer-level Patreon supporters. Hazel, Heather, Donald,
Wisdom Queen, Jenny Love from Broom, Book, and Candle, Tarsha,
Jennifer, Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop, Little Wren,
Christopher, Tanner, Fergus,
Akia Branvanshinik, Jonathan at the Modern Southern Polytheist, Catherine,
Patrick, Peyton, Carol,
Stacy, Montine from Book of My Shadows, Sinara at theauburnsky.com,
Wicked Sense Etsy Shop, Momasera at Conjured Cardea, Jody,
Josette, Clarissa, Victoria of the Distelfink Sipshaft of Iglova,
Leslie, Amy, Sherry,
Clever Kim's Curios, Athena Beth, Beau, and Drew.
To show your support and keep the show going, please consider visiting patreon.com/newworldwitchery and pledging $1 a month or whatever you can. And as always, thanks to all of our listeners.
Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
This time around, we're talking about tarot, divination, and Taoist folk sorcery with author and teacher Benabel Wen. The 64th chapter of the Tao Te Ching, one of the guiding spiritual and philosophical texts of Chinese thought and culture, begins with this verse. What is at rest is easy to hold. What manifests no omens is easily forestalled. What is fragile is easily shattered. What is small is easily scattered. Tackle things before they've appeared. Cultivate peace and order before confusion and disorder set in. A tree as big as a man's embrace springs from a tiny sprout. A tower of 9 stories begins with a heap of earth. A journey of 1,000 leagues starts from where your feet stand. Beginning a new magical practice, or even learning about one, can be a daunting task. Picking up a deck of tarot cards, especially when you've not dealt with them much before, can be overwhelming and go well beyond the simple meanings you get out of the LWB, or little white book, that comes with most decks. Trying to learn something about a system you don't know much about, like Taoist sorcery, can be very tricky, because there are layers and layers of cultural material both underneath and on top of any practices you learn about. That's true for any magical system, even ones that we grow up around. But being familiar with references and ideas used in those systems makes understanding and learning them easier. But, as the Tao says, it's that first pile of earth, that first sprout pushing out of the dirt, or that first impulse to lift our feet that takes us forward. In this episode, we're going to be talking to one of the more remarkable teachers I've met on esoteric practices, Benabel Wen. Benabel is an experienced practitioner of divination, especially the I Ching, tarot, and Chinese bone oracle readings, and she's even designed her own decks to that end. She's written a book on that topic, as well as an excellent book called The Tao of Craft, which explores Taoist folk magic and the creation of Fu sigil talismans, which we'll get into in the interview. The significant role of Chinese Americans in North American history, everything from industry to law to transportation to food to philosophy, has been influenced by people from Chinese and Chinese American backgrounds since the 19th century at least, and the presence of Asian thought and culture in North America cannot be overstated. All of that has shaped some of the magic we find here. To be sure, considering some of the horrific treatment of Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans at various times, there should be little surprise that magic, one of the most powerful reactionary tools against oppression, should be employed to protect or defend those being oppressed. Taoist sorcery, however, is not a topic that often comes up in discussions of folk magic that I've seen, so I'm thrilled that Benabel is sharing her thoughts and experiences with us. She goes well beyond any one esoteric practice, of course, illustrating just how interwoven magic can be between different cultures. I hope you will enjoy this interview with Benabel Wen, and that you hear just how those threads of magic can tie us together as practitioners. For now, let's get on to the interview. Our guest this time around is Benabel Wen, author of The Tao of Craft and creator of the Spirit Keeper's Tarot, a deck that she designed. She also has put together a marvelous website full of resources all about divination, tarot, spellcraft, incorporating Tao sorcery into one's practice. It's a marvelous sort of font of information. So much is available there. We are incredibly lucky and blessed to have you with us tonight. So, Benabel, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, Corey. I'm very honored to be here. So thank you for having me.
So I think we should probably start with you because you're kind of an interesting person. So you're a hardworking kind of professional in the field of law by day. And that's not something that everybody would associate with, for example, divination and mysticism. But I'm curious kind of, where do those two things intersect for you? Does that impact your everyday life? What brought you to studying these sorts of things?
I think I was interested in these topics and understanding the beyond first. And then incidentally, because I'm human and living in the society, at some point I have to choose a career path, right? And it just happened to be law. So I really see that as the dynamic, you know what I mean? It's not that the two went together and I consciously made this choice. Guess what? I'm going to be an occultist and a lawyer. It was more that I've always fundamentally been predisposed to trying to figure out what's beyond. And then the reality is I have to choose a career path. And so for that, it became law. And because fundamentally I'm predisposed to the occult path, it will bleed into everyday life no matter what I did, whether it was law, engineering, nursing. It didn't matter what I chose to go into. The occult side would have bled into it no matter what.
So that's kind of, it's sort of this fundamental underlying piece of you then.
Yeah, for sure. I think so.
Very cool. Let me ask, what was the first divination system you came to? What was it that was sort of your entry point into all of this?
I think the first one I might have been exposed to but never studied myself would be tea leaf reading. My mom and grandmother were really into that. Feng shui, I don't know if people consider feng shui divination. You know how it's kind of dicey, it's on that weird line. But if people consider feng shui a form of divination, then that was an early thing I was exposed to as well. In terms of for myself, it would be the I Ching. I remember my father consulting the I Ching whenever he had a serious question. I'd watch him. He would use the stocks, right? Which is a little bit more of an excessive way than the three coin toss.
Right.
And so, but it's beautiful to watch. So I remember being a child and seeing that and then, you know, being curious about what that was. And he'd kind of show me. And I don't know if I did it correctly at the age of five, but, you know, I would mimic what my father was doing. So technically, that would be my first form of divination.
That's wonderful. I had a friend when I was growing up who did I Ching. And I still remember the sound of the stalks shaking in the it was like sort of a cup that they were using to shake them out. And just what an interesting sort of trance-inducing sound that could be. So you come to this through kind of contact with divination, and you are sort of developing an interest in the occult. I should probably spend a second kind of talking about some of the terms you use, because occult is one of those terms that I think can throw people off. They don't always know exactly what we mean by occult. And you use some really interesting terms when you're discussing the different branches of magic or different branches of mysticism that you are involved with. So, for example, you have the term metaphysician, which I love, that you use to describe some of what you do. You also talk about being a mystic. You discuss Taoism, both kind of as a legalistic system that is sort of part of a fundamental religious philosophy, but also there's this folk tradition side of it that you get really into. So I'm curious, you know, what terms do you use to describe the practices that you're involved with, and what do those terms kind of mean to you?
I think I'm still struggling with that myself. When I say, I mean, I don't even know what occultist means if you really think about it. The more I think about it, the less I understand what occult means too. But I think of all the words availed to us, occultist makes the most sense to me. There's this idea of wanting to study and understand the occulted, what is blocked from view, what is unseen. Mm-hmm. So
just on that very sort of rudimentary level, it makes the most sense to me. Metaphysician calls to mind to me someone who's trying to understand the underlying philosophy of life, trying to understand why things tick the way they tick, right? Mm-hmm. I have no problems with people identifying me as a witch or talking about what I do as a witchcraft. But I think if I'm having conversations with people who are not in the occult or witchcraft communities, using those words can actually be a hindrance. And when I use those words, it becomes, I have to start there and I can't have the productive conversations that I actually want to have. And I have to, you know, really spend a lot of time just dismantling preconceived notions. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And well, of course, everyone in this community knows what I mean. So I think that's the reason there are a couple of words in mainstream settings I'll avoid only because I do want to have productive conversations about occultism. And you can't have those conversations if you use the word magic, because then you have to spend the next hour describing what you mean by magic, right? So mm-hmm. I'd rather have a conversation describing what I'm talking about rather than using terminology that already has very many, many different interpretations.
That's a nice way to put that. And it gets at something I find a lot when dealing with, you know, folk magical traditions. For example, you know, you have Pentecostal Christian practices that involve laying on of hands and things like that to perform healing, which, you know, as somebody who's studying this kind of in a scholarly way, I'm like, oh, that's a type of folk magic. But if you use the term folk magic, there's a lot of blowback on that immediately.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then in terms of Taoist practice, I think if you look at the I Ching, the origins story for the I Ching, and whether or not that's historically accurate, of course, is up for debate. It happened so long ago, allegedly, that we really don't have any historical record whatsoever. But the legend that's associated with it is that it began as a divination system. There was a shamanic king who was imprisoned because the other king was, you know, jealous of him, didn't want him to take over his kingdom. Mm-hmm. And while he was in prison, he was using the Ba Gua, the 8 trigrams, and stacking the trigrams together to form hexagrams, and those formed 64 hexagrams. And using the 64 hexagrams that he had just now designed, he divined that the current kingdom or dynasty would fall and a new dynasty would arise. So if you think about that, the I Ching began as a form of divinatory system. But then I think because you had a lot of Christian missionaries coming into China during the Ming and Qing dynasties and seeing all of this and reinterpreting it. Because if you read the I Ching language, a lot of it makes reference to some concept of a monotheistic god. But it's not monotheism. It's more pantheism, where we believe that everything all together and sort of the multifaceted unity of all gods and goddesses being personifications of different aspects of human life and the conditions here, altogether united, form some sort of collective god, right? And so we call that, there's a word that we use that we call that collective god. And so a Christian missionary coming in and reading these in Chinese might be like, oh, they believe in God too. And so I think to make it more palatable as a Christian missionary or coming from the West, so that you can both practice I Ching and also continue to keep your faith, they had to strip it of the divinatory and the Chinese folk religious aspects of Taoism and a lot of these practices and said, oh, Taoism is just a philosophy. So I think that's the reason today we come away with this conclusion that Taoism is a philosophy, but I think it really began as a religion.
Mm-hmm. And not just, and I like your point about it sort of being pantheistic and sort of seeing the divine and everything, because there's also sort of an animistic side to it as well, or a panentheistic side to it, where it imbues life in places that we might not perceive life normally. So for example, I mean, the typical examples, you know, rocks or mountains might have life, but this can also come down to, you know, your home has a life as well, and things like that. Do you see that as two sides of the sort of Taoist coin, or are they two separate branches that don't really communicate with each other, the sort of legalist and the folk versions of this?
One of the interesting things about Taoism is in terms of how it's evolved over the centuries, it's a lot like Hinduism, where Hinduism, we use the word Hinduism to describe something that in the West we think of as this one religion, but it's actually not. Hinduism is a collective of many, many different regional folk religions. So within this umbrella term of Hinduism, there's actually many, many different sort of facets and perspectives of the gods and goddesses and how they interact. And there's even different mythologies that are imposed upon these different deities. And so in the Chinese society, it's very similar, where Taoism is the umbrella term that we use because there are unifying philosophies among all Chinese. But then how it's practiced on the regional level is very different. And I think the reason for that is what you mentioned, animism. So if where I live, the main attraction is a lake, then the spirit of that lake is really going to inform my practice of religion. And so my Taoism is going to look necessarily different from somebody who is closely tied to and dependent on, say, a mountain or a valley. Or if, you know, even the weather of your region matters a lot, too, because weather is tied to the moods, of course, of the gods and goddesses. And so I think that's why you start to see all these differences. But ultimately, Taoism is actually many, many separate folk religions.
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of makes me think... There's a phrase in Japan where they talk about in Japan you live Shinto but die Buddhist because both systems become this central part of daily life, right? You experience Shintoism on a daily basis, but Buddhism sort of governs the larger festival cycles and the sort of big religious ceremonies. And I'm curious, that kind of idea makes me think of you talk a little bit about Taoism and Confucianism. And sort of working together in unison, in Chinese practice. And I'm curious, you know, is that something that you think of? Is that a parallel that you see as well? That both of those philosophies are actively sort of part of people's daily lives.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's just sort of an incidental part of the history that happened to have taken place in China. You know, you have Confucianism that just happened to rise to dominance in terms of a form of legal philosophy and social philosophy in China. And then Taoism has always remained sort of, it was considered the religion native to China. And so they're intertwined just the way, you know, religion and politics would be intertwined in any society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have this one wonderful lesson I remember seeing on YouTube where you talk about it's sort of this idea that you offer a Confucian practitioner and a Taoist practitioner vinegar. They're both experiencing the same thing. One's going to experience it as sour and one's going to experience it as sweet. And it's just kind of different. Again, it's kind of different flavors of the same thing. I think that's a neat way of thinking about it.
Yes.
So I'm curious, how much of this cosmology, this sort of the Taoist cosmology, either at the folk level or at this kind of larger level, how much does that kind of underpin the practice of the occult for you? And then also, how is that? So how do you think cosmology fits into the occult? Does the occult require a cosmology to be functional, kind of at a general level?
I would be very hesitant to say yes, but for me, the answer is yes. So I think I want to be more subjective and only talk about myself, right? Because I can't talk on behalf of others. So for me, it absolutely is. I think it's sort of the periodic table. It's the elements. It's what makes it a form of science for me. And I need to have some kind of a basis to sort of paint a form of rationalism on top of that. Otherwise, if it's just all sort of free-flowing intuition, I don't have any way of validating, I feel. And so, but that's just my perspective. I really don't think that that's a perspective that's necessary in occultism. For me, it's the underpinning of absolutely everything I do, even not occult things, you know, just it's the entire view on life, you know? And so saying that I'm an occultist is simply just saying, I believe there's an unseen part of everything that I see, and I'm going to make a proactive commitment to understand the unseen counterpart to everything that I can physically experience. And so that's all I mean by that particular term. So the concept of a binary and a trinity and fundamental building blocks informs even my understanding of science, because science does have its corresponding aspects and elements to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the you mentioned the binary makes me think one of the things I think that you do a really good job of navigating in the videos that I've seen from you is dealing with this idea that people like to split the occult or split magic into a binary of light and dark or left hand, right hand path. And you have some really cogent thoughts on that about there really isn't, you don't have one without the other, and therefore they're both valid, both necessary. And I just think that's an interesting point of view. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
I think one of the most intimidating things that I learned from Taoist philosophy is that when you create evil, you've created good. And when you create good, you've created evil. So when my intention is to do good somewhere, in some way, even if it's, you know, in a space-time that I can't perceive in this moment, I have created evil. Right. And mm-hmm. if I do something that's evil in some capacity somewhere, there's a counterpart, something has sprung up that is good. And so I think it's a very intimidating idea because it's so beyond what we can fully comprehend. Right. And yet mm-hmm. I do accept that as a truth. And so because I accept that as a truth, it's hard for me to be as judgmental about, you know, left-hand path versus right-hand path, good magic, like, you know, what's the word again? Light magic versus dark magic or right. whatever mm-hmm. terms are. So it's harder for me to make those really, you know, bright line distinctions between the two because I know that whatever I do, it's both.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that sort of that measured response. It's one of those things where, like, you know, when you tell me that you're involved in the legal field and there's this whole idea of balance, that I can really see why both the occult and law work for you, because they're both about sort of finding balance, finding middle roads, finding places where you can negotiate between, you know, right and wrong or good and evil, places where there are gray zones and things that you need to dive into a little more deeply to understand. I can really see that connection there.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about both law and the occult is that, you know, when you're just starting off, when you're uninitiated and amateur and you're sort of inexperienced, mm-hmm. you have very bright line judgments. You know, the new lawyer, like the young law student, believes you know what's right, you know what's wrong, you know what justice looks like, or so you believe, right? You know who the good guy is, you know who the bad guy is. Mm-hmm. And in occultism, it's the same way, because that's why we have these enduring conversations about light versus dark magic, black versus white magic, right? That's the reason mm-hmm. we have these conversations, and they never, never die. But I think the more practice and experience you get, justice is so messy. Like, you really don't mm-hmm. know what justice is. It's so complicated. Even in terms of trials, there's so much, you know, so many facts and so much evidence that gets suppressed. So you're making these huge life-altering decisions on half the facts, half of the evidence. And when you know the backstories, when you know how far, because things don't happen in the last year or last 2 years, everything goes back and back and back in time. And so when you start seeing, you know, the holistic pieces in either occultism or law, everything's so messy and so gray.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally see that. I kind of love that you can use both of those things in your life. And I don't know, I feel like they may play really well off of each other for you. I don't know. I'm not you, so I have no idea how they work for you, but
I think they do. You know, I think for me, they play off very well.
Good. Well, I should say that the piece that really brought me to you, that sort of led me to find you, you have this really wonderful essay on your website where you talk about parallels between some pagan practices, especially kind of sort of those Western ceremonial occultist practices and Taoist sorcery. For example, you point out that they both depend upon folk knowledge and folk practice, and they both use symbols like pentagrams or circles in specific ways. And at the same time, they still maintain differences. And I'm curious, you know, how does that synchronicity between systems work for you? Is it an advantage in practicing mysticism? Are there disadvantages to it? How does that synchronicity function for you?
And the magic square, too. I think it's so the more you get into it, I'm like, wow, did they copy each other? But I don't think they did. But it's just, it's so amazing how much overlap there is that it's really hard to parse between, like, wait, what did I learn that's Western occultism? And what did I learn that I forget sometimes. I think it's because I do believe very strongly in a universal core truth, something that's out there, but I think some divine, some core truth that is divinity. But I think because we're human, you know, we can look at the same thing and come away with really, really different perceptions of what we saw that might even be oppositional. And so because technically we saw the same thing, you and I, there's going to be a lot of sort of, you know, overlap between what you say and what I say. But then there's also going to be a lot of things that your testimony will be very, very different from mine just because of who you are versus who I am. And we always bring that to the table. We always look at everything through the lens of our ego. And so that really can't be changed. And because you have these two different cultures and then, you know, many, many diverse, you know, sort of singular levels of ego, it's going to be very different. But I think the synchronicities just show to me that there's some core universal divinity out there.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of phrasing that and sort of seeing them both as tapping into that kind of current of source. I dig that. And then I should also say, we talked a lot of kind of philosophy here. This has been a lot of philosophical talk, and you do a wonderful job of summarizing philosophy. I highly recommend anybody check out your videos that talk about sort of the cosmology of Taoism and the sort of philosophy underlying Taoist sorcery, because I've never heard it quite so well explained in such a good tight amount of time. It's sort of a masterclass on it, and I dig that. I also think that you have a lot of fun when you are writing and when you are sharing this information, thinking here of you have a Doreen Virtue demon summoning video where you're showing a reading. You're actually showing a legitimate reading, but you're also kind of having a little bit of fun at Virtue's expense from where she's done this kind of crazy 180 on everything she's ever done in her life.
Yeah.
How important is that sense of humor for you when it comes to the occult?
I've never really thought of it or processed it in that sense. And so I think I should probably be more self-aware and discerning. I think for me, the humor comes in when there's a very important truth I would like to highlight. But then mm-hmm. you want to be thoughtful about the way you highlight it. Because I think if you say, phrasing matters so much. And if anyone understands that, there are magicians, you know, like the magists understand how important words are. You know, words are so powerful and so magical. And if I know that there's some particular point I want to get across, then there's a way that I have to frame it. And so even though when I try to be silly or kind of, it seems like I'm being humorous, I do that intentionally because I believe there's some important point I hope we'll get across.
That's interesting. So it almost functions as a sugarcoating on a very important pill.
Yeah, like the Doreen Virtue example, I felt like that was important commentary that had to be made. You know, I think a lot at that time when a lot of people were very upset in our community about sort of what had gone down, some of the, you know, the things that she had said, but the way it was being framed didn't make us look good. And I don't think it highlighted just how silly she was. And so I felt like, you know, I wanted to do something that was at the heart of it, political commentary.
Mm-hmm. And it comes off very, it's not cruel, which I kind of dig. You are having fun at the expense, but it's not a cruel sort of fun, which I think is valuable as well. Mm-hmm. I should ask, do you have any, with the volume of tarot decks that are out there in the world, and you do, I should say, a really excellent video series called Sightseeing the Tarot, where you talk about different decks, different books, different readings and things like that. And I'm curious, with sort of all the contact you've had with different decks, are there any like kind of silly or funny decks that you particularly like or even, you know, sort of guilty pleasure type readings that you do?
I would say I'm offended that you would call the Hello Kitty tarot silly. I'm very offended. The Sailor Moon tarot. I'm also offended, not at you, but the Sailor Moon tarot is only major arcana. They only have the majors. There's no like full 78 Sailor Moon tarot deck. And so I'm really upset about that as well.
Now I sympathize with you on that. There's a Steven Universe tarot deck that only does the major arcana, and it disappoints me every time. I would totally go for that. I should also mention that you are a deck creator yourself. You have created the Spirit Keeper's Tarot, as well as a really cool Bone Oracle deck that people can actually download from your website, print out for free. And I think that's amazing. You've written a couple of books, the most recent, which is The Tao of Craft, which is a marvelous and very, very thorough resource on the practices that you talk about. I can tell that sharing all of this is really valuable to you. Nobody would share as much information as you share for free if sharing it wasn't important. So I'm curious, why do you feel called to share this knowledge?
I think if I had to psychoanalyze myself, it has a lot to do with my specific, background. My mom came from a poverty-stricken, socioeconomically disadvantaged background, and she was from the deep south of Taiwan. My grandfather, both of my grandparents on the maternal side were uneducated. So my grandfather, his job was actually to cart around. He was a street peddler. So he would create tofu and these bean curds. Mm-hmm. He piled them onto a little cart and drive a little bicycle. And the bicycle was the most valuable asset the family had. And he would peddle the cart of tofu into the streets and sell it. And the only time the kids ate, my mom, was when there were leftovers. So it became bittersweet, because if there were leftovers, they didn't make all the money that they could have made. If there's no leftovers, they made a lot of money that day, for comparatively speaking, but the kids went to bed hungry. And so just seeing that, and then the reason they got into folk magic, and the reason they did sigil crafting and forms of shamanism to southern Taiwan, was because they had no access to healthcare. And so forms of spell crafting became the form of healthcare that they had access to, both mental healthcare and physical, medical care. My mom was really lucky. She ended up marrying my father, who was, very, very wealthy, from a landowning family, like just one of the wealthier families from the north of Taiwan. And then they immigrated to the United States. My father has a PhD. So I grew up in an upper middle class background. And I think my mom never let me forget where I came from. And I think growing up with, seeing how, if you're not of a, if you don't have a lot of education, you speak a certain way, you talk and you behave a certain way. So my mom's side of the family always had that, where you could visibly see, even as a child, they were very, very different socioeconomically from my father's side of the family. So there was this dissonance that I just grew up with, And then since I physically and materially had a lot of, privilege and access and was never in need of anything, I felt like I almost owed it to people to be able to give back as much as I could. And so to the greatest extent possible, I try to level the playing field and make this type of work as accessible as possible to people of lesser socioeconomic means. And so I think that has always been really important to me, because I almost feel like it's my moral obligation.
Mm, that's beautiful. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you sharing that story. That it is hard, especially when you're dealing with, economic classes and things like that, striking that balance of, needing to be able to, make money yourself, but also be able to sort of fulfill that need to share and to, I think you used the word privilege, and I really appreciate that privilege obligates you to share down towards the people who do not have that privilege. And I really like that. You also mentioned, some of the folk magic that they were doing, making things like the foo sigils, I think are some of the things that you do. We should probably define, I'm sure some listeners don't know what those are. Would you mind describing those briefly?
Foo sigils, they come in so many different forms, but the most popular form that people would know of would be on a form of rice paper, and it's sort of painted on, well, calligraphy. They use calligraphy that's penned on, and it looks like Chinese writing, but it's a highly, highly stylized form of Chinese writing. And one of my speculations is actually that because if you look very, very far back, in a lot of the text, the Chinese writing, when it's done by highly highly educated alchemists who were also mm-hmm. government officials, the Chinese writing is legible. You can tell what each word is. But then when you get to the folk practice of it, I think because there was such widespread illiteracy, the folk magicians were using a highly stylized form of Chinese, my speculation only, because they were illiterate. And so it was almost a mimicry of the literacy. But that's just my speculation. And that's based on my observation of the different forms of sigil crafting from different socioeconomic classes and from different types of, alchemists and magicians. Anyway, so it's basically the belief that words hold a lot of power, and you connect to God or divinity. You connect to forms of divinity and spirits through a form of writing. And so that's where the concept of sigil crafting came in. It's basically a form of either invocation or evocation of a spirit, divinity, something beyond, to say, hey, can you come here and help me with this issue? And that's what it is. It's a petition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. That's a really good way of putting it. That makes a lot of sense. Many of these petitions, I think, like you were saying, these are the ways to deal with problems like healthcare, which not everybody had access to, or if they would deal with prosperity, which obviously weighs heavily on people's minds. So, I think that that's interesting to see how that's sort of meeting people's everyday needs. And then do you feel like, the divination looks at kind of longer term problems and issues?
There's so many different forms of divination. I think you have the good old fashioned fortune telling. You have all of the matchmakers, mm-hmm. would engage in some form of divination or astrology to match people's birth charts. So there was that aspect of it as well. Divination, I think it manifests itself differently at different socioeconomic levels. If you look at some of the priestesses and the people who are in Orthodox Taoist lineages that were coming from a background of privilege, they were usually mm-hmm. government officials, they saw divination as a form of cultivating a stronger relationship with God, or their belief is, to achieve immortality, to transcend. And or to cultivate wisdom, it's just all the high, lofty goals and aspirations. But then divination and fortune telling, when you can't even feed every mouth in your family, I don't think you're looking to, transcend and have communion with God. You're really looking to make sure everybody's bellies are full, right? And so your purpose for divination is very, very different from the purpose of divination for somebody who already has it all.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see that. So let me ask you, shifting gears just a little bit, from that, you're practicing these techniques, these methods. They've been part of Chinese culture for hundreds, if not thousands of years in some cases. I'm curious, these are practices that are now, on North American soil, part of what we sort of look at as American culture. We're interacting with American culture. Do you see American culture as influencing, shifting, augmenting, changing any aspects of Chinese American or Asian American occult practices? Or do you see maybe the opposite true, where Chinese American occult practices are shifting American occultism in some way?
I think both. And I think Chinese forms of occultism has influenced the West for a very, very long time. Even when you look back to the 1700s, 1800s, mm-hmm. depending if you call it that long time, but even Aleister Crowley was talking very much about Eastern magic, and he believed he was the reincarnation of one of those well-known alchemists. And he talks about the I Ching a lot in his tarot books, that mm-hmm. every single tarot deck corresponds with an I Ching hexagram. So, it's something that has been intertwined for probably since the Silk Road, and I really believe that. And if you look back at some of the texts, they always have talked about each other. The Nestorian monks from northern China, were borrowing heavily from Christianity, but reinterpreting Christianity through Chinese lenses. And so you always see that cultural exchange. And as for today, I do think that they, because Taoism itself makes room for that. Taoism is very progressive and dynamic in terms of its foundational philosophy. That's why it's a syncretic practice. Whatever Taoism comes in contact with, it's going to take, that's why it's like be like water, right? It takes the form and shape of whatever vessel that it's being put in. And so mm-hmm. it is, when it comes into the United States and the West, it is going to merge and change. And both is a syncretic sort of symbiotic relationship. You know, I think Western occultism will change a little bit from that interaction. And then Taoism itself will change. And it has to. I think when people are a little bit too precious about tradition, that can be dangerous as well.
Mm-hmm. It's I think you maybe mentioned this in your book, the idea that when people are telling you how to practice Taoism, they are far more concerned with the container than the water. And mm-hmm. it's not that it, the water is the important part of that. And I love that you brought up that metaphor, because I love that. And then do you feel like there's an ongoing dialogue of cultures, or do you feel like there's resistance to seeing these things as influencing one another? Are there people that you know, basically they don't want any of sort of mainstream American culture, especially pop culture, interfering with traditional Taoist magic, you know, or conversely, are there people who are like, no, we need to, you know, let's find a way to bring the Marvel superheroes into Taoist magic in some way? You know, do you see that as an ongoing dialogue?
Well, I think there's two conversations wrapped up here, right? So there's the conversation of whether or not something, quote unquote, as serious as Taoist occultism should sort of bleed into pop culture. Mm-hmm. But it always has. If you look at, you know, Chinese film, Chinese pop culture, East Asian, Japanese, like all the Asian pop culture, even the Japanime, like it's so rich with little bits and pieces of you know, romanticized or exaggerated forms of Taoist magic, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because of that, just, you know, ignoring different cultures, just within the same culture, you're going to have people have that conversation. Should there be that much, serious occult principles in pop culture? You know, and that's a conversation people could have. And then the other conversation is the East meets West sort of, you know, cliche conversation. Mm-hmm. How does that cultural exchange work? I think it's the unique case is that particular cultural exchange hasn't always historically been equal. And mm-hmm. I think when there's been a cultural exchange of equal parties, people don't get offended. People don't have issues with syncretizing of the two. In fact, that's kind of expected. It's welcomed. It's encouraged. But I think when you bring in geopolitics and you have these long histories of one side domineering and suppressing the other, and you have these histories of colonization and imperialism, I think that's when things get really complicated. And it becomes a very difficult intellectual exercise to divorce geopolitics from craft. Sometimes it should be divorced so you can focus on craft and you can promote and advance craft. And other times it is still important to recognize that there are political influences on how people feel.
Mm. And then there's also always sort of the risk of sort of exoticizing or turning practices that seem exotic into some sort of a fad. So we saw that happen with feng shui in the 90s, I believe. That was kind of a period where people were tapping into that, and it became sort of a fad for a certain subset of American culture. And then, you know, for example, last year there was a lot of uproar over Marie Kondo's sort of organizational system, which has a spiritual dimension to it, and people were either latching onto it and sort of turning it into a religious phenomenon, or denouncing her in some, quite frankly, fairly racist ways. Mm-hmm. You know, do you ever sort of get concerned that people are going to come to you, take what you have on your website or from your classes, and turn them into something sort of fad or modish?
When I'm being egocentric and navel-gazing, yes, of course, because I'm human, and I don't think you can help having those feelings. But I think if I take a moment to divorce my ego and navel-gazing from the sort of objective thing that's happening, even in East Asian culture, right? So there was a while in China and Taiwan when mm-hmm. people who weren't Buddhist, who didn't even care about Buddhism, were wearing the Buddhist beads, you know, the mala prayer beads, mm-hmm. because there was a while in the, I think it was the late 90s and early 2000s in Asia when that was really, really popular. Like, it was the cool thing for all the kids to have, right? So they'd have like a ton of these mala prayer beads all over them, but none of them had any inkling what it meant, what it was. They didn't even associate it with Buddhism. It was literally just a fashion trend for them. Mm-hmm. But it's, you don't talk about appropriation because it's all within the same culture, right? And even in the West, you have a lot of sort of exoticizing pagan concepts in Hollywood as well. And that's a conversation people have. So I think those conversations always happen. And I think at the end of it all, the core divinity that forms the basis of my practice is immune to those trends and changing fads. So I don't think I should be worried, and I try my best not to worry about it. But because I'm human, and when you take something really seriously, and it forms the whole foundation of how you identify as a person and your outlook on life, and then someone else almost makes a mockery of it. It is hard to digest. It's very, very hard to digest. But I try my best to kind of take a step back and say, you know what? That's not a big deal.
Mm. That's a refreshingly healthy way to look at that. And I appreciate that immensely. So you are a very busy person. You do a lot. You've got multiple video series that you keep up on YouTube and through your website. You have multiple courses that people can take with you, multiple publications that you've put up on your website, as well as you've got these books that you've put out. I hesitate to ask this question because when do you sleep? But what's next for you? You know, if someone is looking for, you know, what's next on the horizon for Benabel Wen, what would that look like, do you think?
Right now, I don't even know, because I've just wrapped up Spirit Keepers Tarot, the second edition, and I think I need a break right now. So I'm trying to take it. I keep telling everybody I'm taking a break, but my actions speak, you know, they betray what I'm saying, because it doesn't look like I'm taking a break. I swear I'm trying to take a break. But I think, you know, I'm just so used to staying busy that it's really hard for me to not do anything. So I think what's next on the horizon will be whatever book makes it to the finish line first. I mean, I have several different books that are kind of cooking on the back burner, and I'm just trying to figure out which one, you know, is calling to me next to finish.
That's wonderful. Well, I can't wait to see which one crosses that particular finish line first. Because I've really enjoyed reading what you write. You do a good job of breaking down often complex concepts into very digestible ways without necessarily dumbing them down. So, if someone wants to get started learning about this material, they want to learn about feng shui, or they want to learn about Taoist sorcery, want to learn about the tarot, because that is a major thing that you do. You talked about the Spirit Keepers Tarot, for example. Where should they go first? Where are they gonna need to go to get this access to you?
I try to make everything hub back in some way to benabelwen.com, my website. There's a search bar in there. So if you go to the search bar and you type in a keyword of something you're interested in, just see what pops up, and then sort of start the rabbit hole from there.
I like that. It is a rabbit hole. I've gotten myself lost on there many, many times, and not in a bad way at all. So, I feel like I always come out of it sort of wide-eyed and like, oh my gosh, I really want to do X, Y, or Z. So it's a good site. Benabel, thank you so much for spending time with us. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to us on New World Witchery. We'll be putting links to your website in the show notes. Just really, really appreciate this. Has been a very insightful interview, and I hope people will check out what you're doing, because I think it is incredibly valuable.
Well, thank you so much, Corey.
All right. Have a wonderful night.
You too.
In one of the essays from her website, where there are literally hours and hours of video and hundreds of pages of free learning resources available alongside all of her viable offerings, Benabel talks about the interlinked web of occult practices we see, including among contemporary witches, pagans, and Taoist magicians. Today, with all the cross-cultural pollination that goes on, it is even more difficult to determine what comes from where, she says. She continues, a lot of the practices I hear Wiccans perform around the house during their Sabbats sound a lot like feng shui to me. Using a special broom exclusively for cleaning negative or stagnant energy from a room by sweeping it back and forth in the air, taking care that it never touches the floor? Maybe we don't use a broom exactly, but that's feng shui. Paganism consists of a great variety of traditions. Likewise, Chinese folk religions cover a diverse spectrum of belief systems. They don't have one identifiable sacred text like the Bible, the Torah, or the Quran. They're polytheistic, yet pantheist, believing that at the heart of matters, we are all one. Because of that belief in oneness, there's a strong veneration for nature, since natural forms contain components of spirit, and that spirit can guide and empower us. That sense of exchange, that unity and focus on enchantment, spirit, empowerment, magic, perhaps that is the first mound of dirt or footstep on our path. In the famous philosophical text and divination manual, the I Ching, or Book of Changes, one verse in the poem Earth Over Heaven, Peace, says, no planes are without bumps. Whatever goes must return. Hardship is in store, but no harm will come. Don't mind the penalty. Take wine with your food. I hope that today, Benabel Wen has offered you an opportunity to learn about Taoist sorcery, tarot, divination, and folk magic more generally. I hope also that we've been able to do justice to her excellent work, and that you too will not mind the bumps or hardships too much on the road to magic, and that you will return to us, ready to eat, drink, and be merry with us once more on New World Witchery next time. Special thanks again to Benabel Wen for joining us today. If you'd like to reach out to us about this or any episode, you can do so at compassandkey@gmail.com, and we'll include links to Benabel's website and contact information for her in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us at Twitter and check out our Facebook page. For those who are interested, we also have a page on Pinterest. We have pages on Instagram and even a YouTube channel with back episodes of the podcast and everyday magic videos. You can leave us a voicemail on our voicemail hotline, which is 442-999-4824. That is 442-99-WITCH. Thank you very much to our supporters on Patreon who make our show possible. If you'd like to help fuel our magic, you can drop a dollar a month or whatever works for you into our magic hat at patreon.com/newworldwitchery. If you can't support us financially, we get that. But please think about liking, commenting, subscribing, and especially sharing us with others to help get the word around. You can also check out our Audible trial program. Visit audibletrial.com/newworldwitchery to get your free trial of Audible, where you can download over 180,000 titles, including some I narrate. Your purchases help support this show, and there's no obligation to continue after the free trial. So until next time, thanks for listening, and be well.